Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, The Independent, New York Times, ClassicRock.about.com, RollingStone.com, BGORecords.com, ClassicBands.com, and Entertainment Weekly. Tell you twice what I can tell you. This opening number, Listen, My Son, is brought to us by a group called The Unseen Guest. The Unseen Guest, will be hearing more about them later on in today's program, but first, these trivia questions.
So I find myself on the highway, on my own.
Our trivia questions come to us from www.whosangthatsong.com. Question number one, multiple choice. Who sang the title song from that 1960 John Wayne Western, North to Alaska? Was it A, John Wayne himself? Or was it B, Stevie Wonder? Or C, Johnny Horton? Or was it D, Sarah Palin? Hint. This song went all the way to number one early in 1961. And question number two, who sang the 1977 version of the song, My Way? Hint, the song was written by Paul Anka for Frank Sinatra, who sang it in 1968. This 1977 version, however, was covered by a famous rock star and released just weeks after his death in 1997. Here's a very short snippet from one of his other songs. See if you can name who sang that. Who is that? Who sang that song? That's a very short hint, isn't it? But see if you can get it. The answers to these two very important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. In the transition section of today's program, we see this article by Gil Kaufman, written for MTV.com on the 25th of October, 2010. Gregory Isaacs dead at 59. Reggae singer was known as the Cool Ruler. The Cool Ruler has died. Reggae great Gregory Isaacs, who earned that chilled-out honorific thanks to his natty dress and emphasis on romantic, yearning tunes, died at the age of 59 at his home in London, following a year-long battle with lung cancer, according to BBC News. Isaacs, best known for his bubbling 1982 hit Night Nurse, gained his nickname as a result of his 1978 album Cool Ruler, on which he perfected the reggae style known as Lover's Rock, a swaying, bouncy sound that mixed the insistent thrum and downbeat of the Jamaican Islands with a 1950s R&B crooner-style vocal. Article skips down. Isaacs, born in Kingston, Jamaica on July 15, 1951, loved listening to American R&B singers such as Sam Cooke and Smokey Robinson on the radio as a child and began making a name for himself as a teenager in the 1960s, performing at talent contests and with other vocalists before going solo in 1970. Article skips down and ends with this. Son and fellow reggae singer Kevin Isaacs, who appeared on the joint 2000 album Father and Son, tweeted a tribute to his dad Sunday night, writing, "Rest in peace, Dad. You're a great father to me and my idol. That's all I can say for now. I'm hurt. My dad just died. Give thanks to all his supporters." Though he was said to have recorded 500 albums in his career, the Times said Isaacs put the number at closer to 200. His final album was 2008's Brand New Me. The next part of the Transitions program is Today in Rock History, brought to us by BGORecords.com, and today is the weekend of November 13th and November 14th. What were the number one hits this weekend? Well, back in 1960 was Ray Charles with Georgia on My Mind. And 5 years later, the Sound of Music soundtrack was number one this weekend. And back in 1968, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly soundtrack, Hugo Montenegro, was number one this weekend. And back in 1976 this weekend, it was Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night. Back in 81, it was The Police, Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic, at number one this weekend. And back in 87, it was Dirty Dancing soundtrack at number one. 1992, Bon Jovi, Keep the Faith, was number one. And back in 1998 this weekend, it was Lauryn Hill, Doo-Wop, That Thing. If you were born on November 13, you share a B-Day with Timmy Thomas. Why Can't We Live Together? He was born on November 13, 1934. Deaths on November 13 include Jerry Lee Lewis, Jr. He died on November 13, 1973. And if you're born on November 14, you share a B-Day with Freddie Garrity, Freddie and the Dreamers. He was born on November 14, 1940. 8 years later, Buckwheat Zydeco was born on November 14, 1948. Back in 1949, a year later, it was James Young of Styx, born on the 14th of November. And finally, Stephen Bishop, born on November 14, 1951. Deaths on November 14 include Keith Reef of the Yardbirds. He died on November 14, 1976. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, a half a century ago this weekend, it was the BBC reporting that Elvis Presley's It's Now or Never has become the fastest-selling single in UK chart history, selling 780,000 copies in its first week. A year later, in 1961, it was Patsy Cline hitting the U.S. country charts with Crazy. And back in 1965, this weekend, James Brown enters the charts with I Got You. Back in 1967, this weekend, Brian Jones buys the former home of A.A. Milne, Winnie the Pooh, in England. And back in 67, that same year, this same weekend, Beatles released Yellow Submarine. Back in 71 this weekend, it was Cat Stevens releasing Tea for the Tillerman. And also back in 71 this weekend, it was Pink Floyd releasing Metal. And finally, in 1992 this weekend, it was Elton John performing for the very first time in Mexico City for over 90,000 people.
Moses, let us live in peace. Let us strive to find a way to make our hatred cease. There's a man over there. What's his color? I don't care. He's my brother. Let us live in peace. Oh.
In local rock news, we see this article written by David Menconi and published in the News and Observer on October 31, 2010, entitled Writer Finds Fame a Little, Well, Freaky. Keep in mind, this was Halloween weekend when this was published, hence the title. Steve Dubner is a literary rock star. As co-author of 2005's Freakonomics, the 47-year-old North Carolina expatriate is one of the forces behind the wildly popular franchise that delves into the psychology of economics. It began a sequel, 2009, Super Freakonomics, a public radio show, a recent documentary movie, and numerous public appearances, including one slated for Thursday in Charlotte. Strangers now recognize Dubner when he's riding the subway home in New York City, which leaves him somewhat aghast. It's not like I'm even remotely famous compared to real fame, Dubner says. But the movie has gotten it to where I get recognized in public pretty regularly, which has become a little uncomfortably weird. The price of fame is interesting to me. Most everybody seems to think being famous would be cool. It would be cool to have the things fame can bring, power, wealth, access. But the actual being famous part is a nightmare. Right now I have this teeny sliver of recognizability. It will fade soon, and that's good. There was a time when Dubner was trying to be a literal, not literary, rock star. A quarter century ago, he played keyboards in a rock band called The Right Profile, fondly remembered as one of the greatest should-have-been stories in North Carolina music history. Local producer Dick Hodgkin remembers the band as a great live act, especially the dynamic between Dubner and guitarist Jeffrey Dean Foster. Jeff was the serious singer-songwriter, very thoughtful, earnest, sincere, says Hodgkin. Steve was this crazy, almost comic relief, a brash, loud, out-of-control rock singer who was just off the chain on the piano. Then when they'd do things together, it became this third thing. The whole really was greater than the sum of the parts. The Right Profile, formed in the early 1980s at Appalachian State University, at first blush an unusual choice for a kid from New York. But Dubner, the youngest of eight kids in his family, liked Appalachian's rural environs, which reminded him of the farm where he grew up in upstate New York. And after his father died when he was 10, times were tight. ASU offered him a full honor scholarship. "This was important, as I had $0 to my name," Dubner says. Dubner had played in a series of bands in high school, all of them terrible, he said, and the Right Profile also was terrible at first, he added. But the group improved fast, building a solid following throughout the Southeast. Dubner's first book, 2000's Turbulent Souls, recounted one night when a bartender explained why a crowd showered the band with empty beer bottles. Oh, that's what they do sometimes when they're really into the band. When they don't like it, they just find the power cord and rip it out of the wall. Eventually, record labels got interested and a bidding war broke out. Arista Records warred out, signing the Right Profile in 1986, but the deal soured and the band never released an album. Dubner decided he'd had enough in 1987, quitting the band to go back to school. "He'd quit before and we'd always talked him back," said Foster, who still performs and records under his own name. "He just always had plenty of other things he could do because he's a smart guy. Playing rock and roll was only one thing for him." Dubner moved to New York and earned a Master of Fine Arts in Writing from Columbia University, figuring he'd write novels and teach college. But a teaching fellowship made Dubner realize he didn't want to teach either. So he went off to write, finding his niche in journalism. Along the way, he married and became a father. He and his wife, Ellen Bender, have two children. As a journalist writing for the New York Times and other national publications, he spent time in a Chicago prison with the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski and 3 days in Los Angeles with Steven Spielberg. The journalism eventually led to books. He was working on a book about behavioral economics when he interviewed University of Chicago economist Stephen Levitt. Dubner and Levitt started kicking around ideas, and they decided to write a book together. Thus was born Freakonomics, a title coined by Levitt's sister. Article skips down. "I've been recommending it to my students for quite some time," says Ralph Burns, an economics professor at UNC Chapel Hill. "In fact, I'm teaching an honors section right now, and I'd say that at least 70% of my students have read it. The book's approach is to apply conventional economic analysis to some very unconventional topics and to prove all sorts of odd theories. It's really brilliant." Even so, there's a part of Dubner that still misses music. He talks wistfully about recently bumping into another of his old Right Profile bandmates, Superchunk drummer John Worster, at the airport in Chicago. "John was on his way somewhere with some band, and I was on my way somewhere to do something Freakonomics-related," Dubner says. "It was great to see him, but also bittersweet. When you're in a band with someone, it's very intense bond. Something else I miss is that I don't enjoy reading my own writing like I did listening to my own music. Music is transportive emotionally, writing much less so." "Yeah, in retrospect, I quit music at a pretty stupid time," he concludes. "I do wish I had a record to show for those years of hard work, but I didn't want to do it anymore. I'm not the kind of person who wants a life where everyone knows who you are wherever you go, or wants to depend on the admiration of others for daily self-worth. As much as I wish I'd made that record, it was still the right move for me." This next article comes to us from Time Magazine, published on the 1st of November 2010. And it's written by Dan Fastenberg entitled Brief History, Presidents, and Pop Culture. On December 8th, Barack Obama will appear on the TV science show Mythbusters, and no, it's not an attempt to dispel rumors about his citizenship. The cameo, which will have Obama test a version of the Archimedes solar ray, an ancient Greek weapon supposedly capable of setting ships aflame using mirrors and the sun's rays, is aimed at boosting student interest in math and science. The use of pop culture by modern presidents to promote policy has become as common as the ritual mocking by Saturday Night Live. When Bill Clinton arrived in office, teens who were embracing the videos of Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and other grunge musicians were committing suicide in record numbers. The solution? MTV. While the April 19, 1994, Enough is Enough town hall on teen violence gained fame for a participant's question about Clinton's underwear preferences, the president also discussed alternatives to jail for convicts. The allure of pop luster to presidents, odd given their perpetual position as the world's most prominent figures, has tempted even those who were otherwise mistrustful of the public spotlight. Baffled by the reach of 1970s counterculture, Richard Nixon consented to Elvis Presley's request to discuss a position as a federal agent at large in the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. For Ronald Reagan, a former actor, combining politics and glitz was second nature. He invited megastar Michael Jackson to the White House in 1984 as part of a campaign against drunk driving. In response, John Roberts, then a young administration lawyer, now the Supreme Court Chief Justice, warned of the danger of using pop culture for policy gains. The glamour often threatens to overshadow the message.
You feel the cold and wonder if you'll ever see the sun. You close your eyes and hope that there is just imagination.
This next article, published in the News and Observer on November 8, 2010, entitled Download is a Bad Word at Record Show. It's written by John Murawski. Raleigh. Twice a year, scores of music junkies converge in a windowless motel convention room here to get their fix of hard-to-find blues, country, rock, pop, R&B, and a dozen ear-shattering alloys of heavy metal. Here is pure oral treasure, forgotten by commercial radio stations years ago, awaiting rediscovery for as little as a dollar per vinyl record. Seek and you shall find obsolete discs, waxed by tunesmiths of every persuasion, lately salvaged from some garage or attic. They await your gaze alongside newly pressed vinyl compilations and imported multi-CD sets for the audiophile and completist. More than 300 connoisseurs, driven by collecting mania or simple nostalgia, scooped up the Black Ivory Sunday at the Record and CD Collectors Show at the Holiday Inn near Crabtree Valley Mall. Their tastes spanned the musical range of the past century. They were united in their lack of enthusiasm for downloading audio files stored in binary code on some faraway server with nothing concrete to show for their effort. There is a benefit to getting out of your mom's basement, getting into the sunshine, driving over to one of these things, and actually feeling the physical album in your hand, says Michael Pottorf, the event promoter. The customer Sunday included a Raleigh stockbroker looking for a classic rock, a Wake County Superior Court judge searching for soul and funk, and a Harnett County high school teacher who is, like, totally into really cheesy 1980s pop. They say rock and roll is for the devil, that's a bunch of baloney, said David Collins of Garner, a man with a soft spot for Bread, Lobo, and the Carpenters. This is not demonic, it's romantic. Sure, they can still buy most of this stuff on eBay or order it online from the music superstore, but Customer Sunday said over and over they don't know what they want or what they've been missing until they see that title printed on the cover in those familiar eyes peering at them from a dust jacket. Little Milton, Bobby Sherman, Edie Gourmet, the Royalettes, Tammy Terrell, along with a host of the obscure and unforgettable, grinned and posed on faded covers, pleading for the opportunity to leap out of your subwoofers and into your living room. Running your fingers through the stacks of obsidian platters and CD cases, you could pick up an old Commodores or Steve Miller Band album for less than the price of a small order of fries. Or you could splurge on a Jimi Hendrix box containing three LPs of the guitarist's Woodstock performances, all yours for $145. Better yet, how about an original 1956 Capitol pressing of Blue Jean Bop by Gene Vincent and his Blue Caps for $300. It's scarcer than hen's teeth, said vendor Mike Vail from Chapel Hill. Article skips down and ends with this. An unusual sight in this plastic underworld was the occasional visitor wearing a suit and tie. But there was Superior Court Judge Michael Morgan, bent studiously over a stack of records from his student days in the 1970s. I'm old school, sunk, soul, R&B, the jurist said. I'm just plugging gaps in my record collection. So what do you know about today's featured artist, the unseen guest? Well, we get this biography from Amazon.com, www.amazon.com, and this is what that site says. The unseen guests make music that is difficult to pin down. Wedding traditional Indian instruments with Western songwriting and guitar, and covering it with rich vocal harmonies, they apply this basic idea to songs that come from every end of the spectrum, sounding sometimes like American folks blues, sometimes like a Parisian taking on Nick Drake, at others like Buena Vista by way of Mumbai. They manage to incorporate Western music with traditional Indian instruments in a way that makes it genuinely new, avoiding patchouli-scented cliché or Bollywood bombast.
And I hear the sound of a tide's rise and fall, and it's getting loud as it breaks on the shore.
The unseen guest came about when Declan met a myth while he was traveling through South India in 2002 with a $5 balsa wood guitar. The two became friends and met again in Mumbai, where Amit was based, where they spent several weeks jamming, busking, and singing to anyone who'd listen. Later in the year, while Declan was still on the road, Amit sent him an email suggesting recording an album mixing Indian music with Western. Declan, busy working at the bottom rung of the Australian job ladder, was only too happy to accept. The following year, they met up again in Amit's hometown of Calicut in Kerala, assembled a rotating cast of local musicians, and set to work on recording their debut album. The result was an album entitled Out There, a self-produced album that belies the freewheeling spirit it was made in, with a soul that shows its international origins and a natural sound that doesn't sugarcoat the excellent live playing of its participants. The album melds left-field Western music with Indian in a way that has never been done before. Their second album, Checkpoint, like their first album, beautifully weaves two influences into a seamless whole. The instrumentation combines bluesy melodies. Check out the harmonica work of Curtis King on Miracle Mile, with elements from pop, folk, rock, and free jazz. At times world-weary, at times full of joy. Checkpoint is a traveler's diary, full of witnessed dualities and memories recorded on the spur of the moment. Not the clichés of East and West, but the stuff of novels and good movies, wanderlust versus security, love versus cynicism, the wildness of Saturday night and the regrets of Sunday morning. Checkpoint is an apt title for the Unseen Guest's second album. With it, Declan and Amit acknowledge the successful musical territory of their first album, but they keep moving forward, a solid collection of 11 songs. Checkpoint combines the best of two or more worlds. That unseen guest have produced yet another beautiful dusty snapshot of life on the road, one you can sing and dance to. Unseen guest will also close out today's program with a song entitled Anywhere, Somewhere. This next article was published in the News and Observer on the 28th of October, 2010. Keith Richards, Riff Roaring Life. It is 3 p.m. in the New York office of Keith Richards' manager, and Richards has an appointment. Come on in, he'll be here in a minute, an assistant says, and here he comes in a minute at 3:01. This is from a man who once prided himself for operating on Keith time, as in the security staff ate the shepherd's pie that Keith wanted in his dressing room. Then everyone in this packed stadium can bloody well wait. The Rolling Stones don't play until another shepherd's pie shows up. Chalk up the promptness to the man's new incarnation. He is now Keith Richards, distinguished author who has written The Keeper, Life, a big, fierce, game-changing account of the Stones' nearly half-century-long adventure. It's the most difficult thing I've ever done, he says about the book. I'd rather make 10 records. But he sounds anything but weary, and he seems refreshed, bearing surprisingly little resemblance to the battered, coal-eyed pirate Keith Richards, who looks like 50 miles of bad road. Today, in neutral steak clothes and hot green shoes, he is positively debonair. He has been through quite a lot of phases, and they're all on the page in Life. The Boy Scout, really. The Astonished New Star, the heroin-addicted older one, the jaded veteran of countless world tours, and the longtime sparring partner of Mick Jagger. Despite tabloid shock over the bickering in the book, these two have seriously been calling each other names at least since the early 1980s. But the book's single biggest stunner is a handwritten note on its jacket flap. Believe it or not, I haven't forgotten any of it. It's only rock and roll. Once again, a book by Keith Richards entitled Life. We end up today's program with a quote from Frank Zappa, quoted in Forbes.com, and also published in The Week, October 15, 2010. Without music to decorate it, time is just a bunch of boring production deadlines or dates by which bills must be paid. So, how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Question number one, who sang the title song from that 1960 John Wayne Western, North to Alaska? It wasn't Sarah Palin, and it wasn't John Wayne. It was, in fact, Johnny Horton. And question number two, who sang the 1977 version of the song My Way? That was, in fact, Elvis Presley. Frank Sinatra had done so back in 1968, and this was against the better advice of Paul Anka for Elvis to do it, but he did it back in 1977. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.